Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. We're now in episode number 536. My name is Camden Busey. I serve as the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grayslake, Illinois. And we're delighted to be back with you. I have with me Jeff Waddington, who serves a stated supply of Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you.
Yes, we also have Jim Cassidy, pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim.
As always, great to be here, Camden.
And yeah. Jeff. Well, we've got good crew here of three, and we're calling in and going to have kind of an open-ended conversation today where we're going to address some listener feedback, some questions that were written into our email address, mail@reformedforum.org, and also have an opportunity just to share a few thoughts and kind of have, I guess, kind of a new segment called What We're Contemplating. We'll see how that goes. But, you know, I've been reading a handful of things and been chewing on some ideas, and I'm sure the other guys have as well. So we'll bat some of those ideas around and just kind of an open forum. I guess this could be something akin to, you know, the salons of a couple hundred years ago. You guys know about those?
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to say it was be a symposia or a symposium, but I don't have anything to drink here but my coffee, and I'm at church. I don't know if they'd want me to bring something in, so that'd probably be a problem. The symposium, you know, nowadays symposiums don't have liquor.
But, I did not know that was the key element.
It was. It was like convivium, you know that, like together drink.
Yes, right.
Anyway. Gotcha. We're all over the place here, but
we need to revive that practice, I think.
Yeah,
yeah,
right here,
exactly.
Let's look up the Book of Knowledge here. In ancient Greece, the symposium from I can't read because it's. I got to zoom in here. What's the word? Sumpinane, to drink together, was a part of a banquet that took place after the meal when drinking for pleasure was accompanied by music, dancing, recitals, and conversation. So there you have it.
There it is.
There it is. I think there's a proper place for that.
Proof that you should not base current usage on etymology.
Indeed, indeed. You should not. When we talk about the power of God, it's not dynamite power. Am I right?
Do we need to explain that, really?
Well, I've heard that plenty of times in the sermon, you know, because the Greek word for power is dunamis. And there is an etymological connection that comes to dynamite, but just because the English word dynamite comes from the Greek word dunamis doesn't mean when we see the Greek word dunamis in the Bible that it's talking about dynamite power. Anyway, this is explosive power. The explosive power of the gospel. Maybe, but probably not.
You've been in some interesting church.
Maybe I've heard one or two of those in person, but largely, you know, either in a commentary. Maybe that says something about the commentaries I've read in the past. Who knows? You hear it time and time again. That's one of those things. It's like a meme, and this is more of the proper use of the word meme. I was listening to the Final Four, and the announcer said meme. It's not meme. It's meme. But a meme.
I heard that.
Did you hear that too?
I
was like, ooh, that's going to become a meme in its own right. It was with the Michigan game when Mo Wagner jumped over and kind of he stepped on one of the analysts' glasses, and then Grant Hill had this horrified look on his face because he was worried he was going to get run over. But anyway, here's where meme comes from. It's actually an intellectual reason. A meme is an idea, behavior, or style that spreads from person to person within a culture, often with the aim of conveying a particular phenomenon, theme, or meaning represented by the meme. So a meme acts as a unit for carrying cultural ideas, symbols, or practices that can be transmitted from one mind to another through writing, speech, gestures, rituals, or other imitable phenomena with a mimic theme. So people know what a meme is in social media. It just kind of passes around. But the word meme is a neologism that was actually coined by none other than Richard Dawkins. Oh. And here the Book of Knowledge says it originated from Dawkins' 1976 book, The Selfish Gene. Dawkins' own position is somewhat ambiguous. He welcomed a guy named N.K. Humphrey's suggestion that memes should be considered as living structures, not just metaphorically, and proposed to regard memes as physically residing in the brain. Later, he argued that his original intentions, presumably before his approval of Humphrey's opinion, had been simpler. So there are people, there's a field of study called memetics, and it's kind of, as far as I've heard from other scholars, this is definitely not my field, but some people would try to apply kind of a genetic notion to culture. And so you might end up with certain artifacts or certain ideas that transmit themselves like a gene would through biology, and in their mind, in their worldview, through evolution, natural selection. They would say there are similar activities going on in culture, and that instead of a gene being passed, like a meme would be this kind right. of unit that passes from one mind to another, one group to another. So if anyone cares, that's where the word came from. It's not memey, it's meme.
Kind of makes you wonder whether they had the idea of that being lacking intentionality. In other words, the thing passes from one mind to another accidentally or adventitiously.
Possibly. But the word comes kind of from the Greek meme.
Yeah, mimesis. You
know, or mimesis. Mimesis, right? There's a different cognates, you're right. But basically to imitate. Mimema would be like an imitated thing, or mimesthai, to imitate, or mimos, a mime. So mimes, there
on
you
the,
go.
on the, you know, the pronunciation thing and the faux pas during the basketball game.
Yeah, I feel for the guy.
Before I ever, you know, because you see the word on the internet, but you don't speak it.
Oh, sure.
You read it on the internet. You don't hear it spoken. So I was in a group of people, and it was before I had ever, this is a while ago, before I ever heard it spoken, and I pronounced it a mem.
Oh, yeah.
and I got duly mocked and shamed for mispronouncing. Oh,
well. Well, you should have said that's one of the Hebrew letters, you know, but me.
if I were quick enough, I could have.
Quick recovery, right?
Oh, wow. Well, too bad. But yeah, when you have a job where you're speaking out, you know, out loud in public, sometimes you're going to end up in those positions. It just happens. So I feel for the announcer, but, I'm sure his producer was in his ear after the fact, but, nothing to do about it at that point on live television. Well, to more important things, you know, we've been doing these episodes for such a long time. We've covered so many topics. We're on episode 536 today. I'm very happy to be here talking about more things. But there's always more to speak about, and as the theological world and changes and as new issues arise, certainly there are opportunities for us to discuss new matters and also sometimes to revisit old matters, because we've had, you think about it, if we've been doing this for over 10 years, which we have, then, you know, obviously there are going to be very few people who've listened to everything we've ever done. And to be quite honest, I forget the episodes we've done, and I, you know, edited them all. I'm sure you guys feel the same way. You start to wonder, well, what did he talk about? Did we talk with so-and-so, or was that just a private conversation? Did we record that, or what did we speak about? So sometimes it's nice to get back and talk about some other things. So we're going to address some issues here, pulling out the emails. Of course, you can always contact us at mail@reformedforum.org. You can also tweet us at Reformed Forum, and we like to take those messages and get back to you privately often. Sometimes we're not able, well, most of the time we're not able to get back to everything everybody sends us, but we do stuff them away and sometimes save them for episodes such as this. So let me fire off here with the first question here. This comes from, I'm going to say names. Sometimes I don't, because we don't specify one or the other, but I don't think there's anything in any of these questions anyone's going to have a problem with. Nothing private, of course, but here, this one comes from a brother named Christopher Andino. Hey guys, I want to start by saying, this is going to sound self-promotional. I want to start by saying that I love and enjoy your guys' podcast and listening to it often. Well, thank you, Christopher. Now here, he says, I am a student at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, and I was wondering if I want to better understand Van Til, which books should I read in order? I've already been taking both apologetics class here at WTS, but I want to further my knowledge of Van Til. I think that's a great question. So the question is not just what to read, but what to read and in what order. Now, Christopher's already
ask a question that's up our alley or something.
Yeah,
Christopher's already a student, but let's back up and speak, you know, even for the beginner and the person who doesn't really know anything about apologetics. Where would you start? And then let's get into some of the works of Van Til and what order you might read them. Where would you guys start if someone wanted to come to you and they said, where should I start in apologetics in general? And then let's get to CVT.
I guess my credo.
Yeah.
That would be little pamphlet. The easiest. Yeah, that would be the easiest thing in terms of the depth of discussion to deal with. But there's so much that's, pardon the pun, presupposed behind that.
Yeah.
But it would be a good introduction to Van Til's thought. But that's what it's hard to know whether you just want to tackle it chronologically, start with his earlier stuff and work toward his later stuff, or whether you want to go with the best of. I mean, I think we all would agree with the ones that are the most significant in Van Til's library.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas there, Jim?
Yeah. Well, boy, I'm kind of inclined to direct people the way in which I was introduced to Van Til because that was my experience. But I do think in terms of primary materials, I would begin with his Christian apologetics book. I think that's it. Mm-hmm. That's a nice entryway. That's kind of where I came into it from. And then I would go on to, Defense of the Faith, which is very important. His introduction, Don't Leave Seminary Without Having Read His Introduction to Systematic Theology.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I think that's huge. And that's kind of a good way to start. I think that it's really important to get into some of the debates over Common Grace and the Gospel. So his Common Grace and the Gospel volume is very good, very important. And I'm kind of inclined towards his stuff on Bart. I think that if you want to understand how a Reformed Christian should read and criticize Karl Barth, I couldn't think of a better place to go than the New Modernism and Christianity and Barthianism, as those two volumes are available. And then of course, Jerusalem and Athens has some great interaction in there, some important pieces. Some of those pieces in Jerusalem and Athens, many of them, in fact, are critical of Van Til's apologetic. You think of Montgomery's article, right? Once Upon an A Priori or whatever it is. That's an important one where Van Til responds to it and addresses a very common mistake in terms of trying to understand what Van Til was trying to do apologetically. That's kind of the short list. I don't know if that's necessarily the order that I would go in, but I think that's probably my best shot. But I'd like to echo, Jeff, what you said, my credo and why I believe in God, those little pamphlets that are important to see a more popularized approach to Van Til's method.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would add Christian Theistic Evidences, or should we just say all the volumes that have been produced by CNR? But I mean the ones that have been reissued with explanatory notes, with the nicer covers.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely
those volumes. I suppose so. I mean, you could set yourself. You could get the Van Til works through Logos. And just read everything, which I suppose at the end of the day, if you're really interested in him, that would be the way to go. And then just do it chronologically.
Right. Yeah, you could do that. What would you guys say in terms of secondary literature expositors of Van Til? What would you direct people to say, okay, maybe you're struggling as you read Van Til? And let's be honest, Van Til is not the most natural user of the English language, and there are times where it can be rough going. In terms of expositors of Van Til's thought, any suggestions on where we can direct people to the secondary literature?
There's I think of four writers, but before I do that, I wanted to plug John Meather's biography because I think that's a really good kind of get you. That would be okay. That's where we would tell people, I think, to start read the biography, because that'll give you some of the context of Van Til's life and thought in a very readable and interesting format. And so that's
I agree. I think definitely you want to read the biography. I don't know if you'd have to start there, but maybe very soon, early on in the reading. But for me, I did find it quite useful to have some secondary literature to guide me in my reading. And things like Reform Forum didn't exist at the time. You can, of course, listen to our podcast where we try to explain some of these things. That would have been a help when I was first learning Van Til, which is why we started the program, to help people work through these things. So now we're very thankful for all of our listeners and the way that we've been able to contribute to this discussion. But in terms of secondary literature, Jim, I would still recommend first and foremost Scott Oliphant's book, Covenantal Apologetics, Principles and Practice in Defense of Our Faith. I think it's good. It's comprehensive. It's solid. I think it's most useful. If you need something a little more introductory for like a Sunday school, or if that proves to be a little bit too difficult for you, then you can read his book, The Battle Belongs to the Lord. That's also very good. But in terms of other readers, I would suggest reading Bonson's book, Van Til's Apologetic Readings and Analysis. The reason for that is because almost half the book, at least half the book, is Van Til's own writing. And so but he takes a long time and explains a lot of these selections in a way where it's kind of like a commentary on Van Til with an edited selection from Van Til's entire corpus. That's very useful. Also, Frame is helpful in many places, John Frame, to talk about Van Til, but we've discussed before, and so there's always an in-house debate about how to read and interpret Van Til. My own personal assessment on some of these matters is that Bonson is very good on the nature of transcendental argument. He's also very solid on having a very good grasp on Van Til as a whole, but I don't think he grasped or understood how integrated Van Til was on his Trinitarian theology and how significant that was for his apologetic. But Dr. Frame, I believe, gets a lot more of what Van Til was saying in terms of his doctrine of the Trinity. But then in John Frame's book, I think it's Apologetics to the Glory of God, he doesn't identify or recognize the uniqueness or distinction of the transcendental argument as opposed to being just a modified form of the analogical argument, for example. So, those are some matters to discuss down the road and things we could have further conversation on. But it's good to read widely. But I think a great place to start would be Scott Oliphant's book, Covenantal Apologetics. Then I would suggest perhaps reading Christian Apologetics by Van Til, slogging through Defense of the Faith. It might be hard. But I think at some point, this happened to me. I remember exactly where I was. I was on the campus of Bradley University in one of the dorm halls. And I was reading Van Til, and it had been really hard to that point, and not that it's not hard now, but it's like a light switch turned on. It's like all of a sudden I kind of understood what he'd been saying, and like I had some sort of like hermeneutical key to understanding his way of talking. And that just happened with perseverance. You know, I don't think that was some sort of like revelation or anything, but it was kind of a eureka moment. You know, it's like, oh, it clicked into place for me. And then Van Til just was a much easier read. I got him. I don't know. I had some sort of more basic, more fundamental understanding of him, even though I was still, you know, becoming more and more reformed at the time. Did you guys have an experience that way? I don't know. I think one way to do that is just to read Van Til. And even if you're struggling, you know, have people help you, but just persevere, because I think at some point in time, it's going to click for you.
I mean, I think that's true with any author. Eventually you have to read if you want to be intelligent about an author, you read the primary sources. In terms of another secondary item would be Bonson's Always Ready.
Oh, yeah, I like that a lot.
That was an early attempt to provide the biblical basis for Van Til's apologetic. Mm-hmm.
Then there's his follow-up, which was published posthumously because the manuscript was lost. It's Bonson's Presuppositional Apologetics Stated and Defended. That's also a very useful book, but there's a chapter in there which distinguishes Van Til's notion of presuppositions from many other quote-unquote presuppositional apologists. So that's a handy chapter. If you've ever wondered how Van Til is different from Schaefer or Carnell or Clark, those guys who sometimes might be called a presuppositional apologist, that's a good way, a good place to go.
Yeah, right. That's really helpful. Also, what was useful to me was listening to the Bonson debates, where Bonson debates atheists. And for me, maybe it's because I have an inclination to work towards the theoretical, perhaps through the practical, so you can see the theoretical in practice when you're listening to the Bonson debates, and you can see the way in which he appropriates Van Til's insights in the actual practice of apologetics, which is, you know, for me, I found to be extremely helpful. I think maybe without, you know, beating this one too hard, I think if we're the more advanced, if we're, you know, to move from beginnings, I think we've laid a good foundation. If you want to get a little, if you want to get more advanced, I might encourage people to go ahead and pick up people who influenced Van Til's thought. I found it helpful as I was as I read through and was reading through Voss and Bovink particularly, and reading those guys, I begin to pick up some stuff as to, oh wow, that was a really clear articulation of a particular doctrine that, in retrospect, now having read Van Til first, I can see Van Til was building from and building on top of. So for the more advanced reader, of course, you know, expand out and read those that influenced Van Til the most, which of course are Voss and I think Bovink. And if I could just wax a little self-promotional here for a moment, I've been commenting on Van Til's writings over at Reform Forum blog, under the title The Essential Van Til, and then I take up different topics. And really, it's what that is just a commentary on certain passages of Van Til's writings that I found to be particularly interesting or mm-hmm. stimulating. So for those who may be interested, those particular blog posts could
also
stimulate the thought.
On that line, perhaps the last thing we ought to say on CVT is that I'm actively working with some other people on publishing Van Til's letters. So we're in discussions to try to get a deal on that and try to get a green light. So we've been working on that for a while. I've been thinking about it and, you know, began work on it in earnest 10 years ago, but now we seem to be more in a position. So Ryan Noah has been a great help, and he's studiously working through a digital copy of the you know, photographs of many of these archives that Westminster Theological Seminary has. But I've been in conversation with several people and several scholars and hopefully trying to find a way forward to providing shape to this project. So maybe in future years, hopefully not too long, there'll be other primary sources to read that have not been accessible heretofore. This is great stuff. This isn't just, you know, friendly letters back and forth. I wouldn't say that they're non-friendly, but you know what I mean? There's theological substance in these letters. That's what I mean.
Again, if we could just dig a little deeper here, because I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention Dr. Gaffin's great article on 1 Corinthians in the WTJ.
Right.
which to me was extremely helpful to give exegetical thoughts to what exactly Van Til was after, and why it is that Van Til's thought and his apologetic method is not just a philosophical technique, but it's exegetically grounded in the Word of God. So anybody have the bibliographical information at hand on that article?
Well, it's in the spring 1995 edition of the journal, I believe, isn't it?
That's right.
Van Til, the Van Til issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's the Van Til. It's a commemorative issue, I think, is perhaps the language.
Yeah, it was the 100th anniversary of his birth.
That's what it was. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so all the right, spring 95 issue of the WTJ is a very special edition that's all devoted to Van Til. I don't know if it's possible to get copies of that. I mean, if you have access to databases, you can. I've got a copy. I think I actually have two copies myself. But I don't know if they have any more, if you want to buy a back issue from Westminster.
That's such a great issue. That needs to be republished as something that can be just picked up at the store, right?
Yeah.
Does anybody know if Dr. Gaffin has reissued that article anywhere else in any other
not
books?
I'm aware of.
I thought he treated some of that exegesis somewhere else. Is he in the New Essays on Apologetics, the Revelation and Reason volume?
Oh, he is.
Is that a reworking of his piece in there, or what? Did he write something different?
I can't recall. I think the 1 Corinthians 2, right? That article is unique amongst his work.
Well, I've got the book here. Let me look what. No, yeah. Richard B. Gaffin, Jr. This is in Revelation and Reason, Epistemological Reflections on 1 Corinthians 2, 6 to 16.
Oh, that is the article.
That's what I thought. Yeah, so it got.
Okay, good. So it is available. Good.
Yeah. Okay.
Excellent. Thank you.
That's published by PNR, co-edited by Dr. Oliphant and Dr. Tipton.
The fourth person would be Dr. Tipton's work. Anything he's doing on Voss will be indirectly related to Van Til.
And his dissertation.
See the light of day in two or three decades, I guess.
Hopefully before the second coming of our Lord.
Before the second coming.
I'll tell you, if Jesus comes back before Lane publishes, and I don't care about Lane publishing. I'll take the Lord.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I agree. That's true.
I'm Lord Jesus.
Sorry, Lane, but yeah, Jesus takes our priority.
Everything else.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So, I got to say that I don't want to tease our audience too much because we don't have it available yet, but that dissertation was absolutely eye-opening for me in terms of being able to penetrate the depths of Van Til's thought, and most significantly of all, the way that the doctrine of the Trinity serves foundationally for him and his approach to apologetics. It is so true. It's really important to be able to take what Van Til was saying and to actually practice it and all that. But if all you come away with Van Til is kind of like, oh, here's a neat little trick I can pull on an atheist, right? Or here's a neat little technique I can use and cleverly win an argument. But you don't get the fact that at the center of what Van Til is doing is the self-contained ontological Trinity. Then you've missed something. You've missed the gem.
Absolutely. Now, as I understand it, when the book finally does get published, it'll be greatly reworked. So, you know, won't be
right.
The,
you can get it from the dissertation database right now, but what you're going to get 10 years after the fact is going to be much improved and expanded. He doesn't disagree. I'm not going to speak for him, but I could tell you he doesn't disagree fundamentally with anything you wrote back in 2004. But you're going to get a much even more rigorous, robust treatment of Van Til's Trinitarian theology and how it pertains to other subjects, especially theological controversies and issues that have arisen since the completion of that dissertation back in 2004.
Right.
Yeah. 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 So look out for that. And of course, if you're around Westminster, it's worth your kind of popping into the library there and picking the dissertation up off the shelf and checking it out. Don't take it. Check it out. borrow it. Return it. But go ahead and read it as.
Well, if you're there, you can download the thing. This isn't a secret. You can download it on PDF.
PDF onto your.
If you're
your
there,
flash drive.
Just use the.
If you're there,
get to the database
and
then you can download the PDF. But
I think you can send it.
I mean,
to your
I have one. I have a copy myself, but I'm not in. I'm not at liberty to email it to people. But you could get to the Westminster campus, you can just download one.
Exactly.
There you go. So I'm sure his publisher doesn't want anyone to know that.
Yeah, well, they do now.
Anyway, well, the new edition is going to be
out, so
much better.
Are we,
I know.
Why are we worried now?
All right, question number two here. So a lot to think about there. So now that we offered no clear path for Christopher, we'll move on to our next question. I'll leave the name off of this. I don't know, because it might be a bit personal. This man writes, my wife's friend attends a Church of God Seventh Day. So I assume that's a Seventh-day Adventist church. Maybe I'm wrong, but he's asking, I was wondering if you could please recommend a resource that argues for why we worship on Sunday. Any recommendations would be greatly appreciated. Thanks. So I'm sure any of us would be able to articulate an argument about why we ought to worship on the Lord's Day, but are there any readily accessible resources that somebody can use, either something they could listen to or perhaps a shorter book they might be able to read that would articulate this case in a compelling way?
I would think in terms of a basic meat and potatoes, anything that's dealing with the confession or the catechisms, because it's addressed. The change of days from Saturday to Sunday is addressed, and of course it's attributable to the resurrection. That's the thing, right? The eschatological inbreaking of the end of the age is brought forward.
Right.
So, I mean, that would Gaffin's book on Calvin and the Sabbath be of any value, or would that be wide of the mark?
I think that'd be good. That might not be exactly what they're looking for here. I'm sure Danny Hyde has some resources and books that are available here on Lord's Day worship. I'm almost certain. I'm trying to find the name of them. But I found his resources quite helpful. But yeah, for example, you could read Chad Van Dixhorn's recent study of the Westminster Confession of Faith. He's got a commentary on that, and his wife, Emily, has a handy kind of study guide. That would be very useful, particularly on the Lord's Day questions. G.I. Williamson also has a commentary, which would be useful.
R.C. Sproul has three-volume commentary.
Danny Hyde may have some articles. It's H-Y-D-E. You could do a search for him. I'm apologizing that I'm not finding what I'm looking for right now. But he has a book, Welcome to a Reformed Church. It's very handy, but he's also written quite a bit on the Lord's Day, and I'm almost certain one of those resources has some great material on why Sunday, not Saturday.
To me, it's not a hard question to answer, but we're trying to think of something more extensive than simply saying the resurrection. Although that to me is a settling factor. You could go and you could look at, well, in the New Testament itself, you have reference to Paul preaching on the Lord's the Sabbath, that when Eutychus falls out of the window, you remember that incident. There are also other references, I think, when Paul's in Philippi, is that when they run into Lydia at the riverside? Isn't that on the Sunday?
I don't know.
There is, of course, the Apostle John.
Yeah, he sees the Lord and he's in the Spirit on the Lord's
Revelation.
Day.
Revelation, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that's not Saturday.
Right. We need our brother Glenn. Glenn would just be off. Yeah. He'd be off to the races on this one.
A couple of other resources. I'm actually embarrassed to say why I knew these, because during my licensure I was called up short on my doctrine of the Sabbath, and so I had to write a paper on the doctrine of the Reformed doctrine of the Sabbath. And so because of that shortcoming in my knowledge, I know some of these things. But Walt Chantry has a nice little book called the Sabbath a Delight, which addresses this. Joey Piper has a book on the Sabbath as well. I don't remember the title.
Is that the Market Day of the Soul?
No, that's Dennison. James Dennison's. Yeah.
James Dennison. What about the Nicholas Bound book that Coldwell was involved with publishing and books? I can't imagine there's not anything on this issue in that book.
That's
another book
one.
On the Sabbath. Seemed to me that would have some discussion of the change of days.
Right. One of my favorite pieces is, and maybe you guys can help me because I'm drawing a blank as to where it's at, but Dr. Gaffin's exegesis of, is it Hebrews 4?
Yeah, and the fifth, and pressing toward the mark.
Pressing toward the mark. He also has something in that, the three volumes, Westminster Confession into the 21st century.
Yeah.
Or 20th
okay.
century. There's something related. But anything on on Hebrews, if you have a good redemptive historical reform commentary or article on the book of Hebrews, seems to me this is so basic. To me, it's hard to understand how anybody could think that we should still be worshiping on Saturday.
It was Danny Hyde's book, Welcome to a Reformed Church. I found the reference now, and that's a good place. But you're right. Anything on Hebrews would be handy. But I think maybe in summary, a commentary on Westminster Confession of Faith and possibly Danny Hyde's book, Welcome to a Reformed Church, would be a good 1-2 punch. And simple enough.
Wouldn't we argue that it's the resurrection brings in the new creation, not in its consummate stage, in its pre-consummate stage, and the Sabbath moving from Saturday to Sunday is related to that resurrection occurring in time and space, rather than all at the end of the age.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a radical change. It's a radical change. It's a break with. It's not a break in terms of a complete break with regard to what we do on the Sabbath, but certainly with the day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole issue of Saturday is looking forward to, and Sunday is looking back on.
Right. In the Old Testament, you looked forward to their coming rest, and now we look back upon the finished work of Christ.
Right.
And the Spirit was given on a Sunday,
right.
You know, so there's a lot to be said there, but I'd say those would probably be some good resources, handy for folks. One more question, then we've got some, what we're thinking about. So I've just finished, Paul Waldron writes, so I've just finished, Machen's Defense of the Faith. I assume he means here. I've just finished Machen's Christianity and Liberalism. So I was raised a fundy, he says, and wonder, when is it appropriate to discuss prolegomena? I'm remembering back to my GMA taking me to hear, he must mean his grandma, taking me to hear Barnhouse and Boyce at 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. As for the current spirit of the age or culture, isn't the demon too deep? I don't know what he means by that, but you guys following him? What's he saying?
I'm not quite sure what he's actually addressing.
Well, let's ask this. When's it appropriate to start to discuss prolegomena?
Well, by its very name, it means
at the beginning.
The beginning word.
Right,
at the
first
beginning.
Away. don't delay. What I love about the way in which Van Til, and I think the Reform generally, although certainly not, I'm not making any universal claims here about the history of the tradition, but it seems as if, prolegomena is, it's not something that you say before theology, but according to Van Til and others within the Reformed faith, prolegomena is theology, right?
It is,
it's not,
correct.
It's not like a speculative thing that you say kind of to set things up for talking about theology, but prolegomena itself is to be grounded in revelation, right? It's to arise from the exegesis of the text. So I think that, I don't know if that's what he's getting at or not, but I think that in terms of a prolegomena, that's something that we should engage in, I think, mm-hmm. theologically first, and lay our foundations not according to human autonomous reason or
Amen.
Speculation, but according to the proper biblical exegesis of the scripture.
Well, just for the sake of discussion, maybe this isn't his intent or not, but let's take some of the themes here in this question, and I'll formulate our own question. So let's say we want to engage in apologetics, and you're speaking with, not just fundamentalists, but here modernists, people who identify as Christians, but yet we find they have so many differences with us, deep-seated differences, that we believe that they're worshiping according to a different religion, right? That's kind of Machen's premise, that that liberalism is not another form of Christianity, but it's a different religion. How do you address those types of fundamental differences in a way that could be effective, when really the difference isn't just an intellectual point or even a directly kind of a theological disagreement, but a different spirit? You know what I mean? At what point can you engage in apologetics and polemics within when one side thinks that they're within the Christian camp and the other thinks that we are of different religions?
Well, it seems to me at any point. I mean, that's what Dr. Van Til would say, right? There's no point at which you can't introduce these topics theoretically. But of course, you know, practically speaking, it depends. It depends on many things in terms of what you're talking about with your acquaintances or family, friends, and so forth. It's a skill that you develop like any other skill. In other words, to be able to introduce a topic in the middle of a conversation in a natural way. You always keep your ears perked up, right? Or if you ask questions, say, why do you think that? What makes you say that? Those kinds of things. And try to expose their underlying foundations. And then you can get at some of the, what we call prolegomena, or words that go before, foundational issues, you know, the basics of apologetics. I mean, I realize it's a challenge because we, of the culture in which we live, where God language is no longer natural, if I could put it that way. Mm. At least in the Northeast where I am, it might be slightly different in the South, although I would imagine that's changing.
Not in Austin.
Okay, well, yeah, right, Austin, but Austin's kind of the...
Even here, though, yeah, in Illinois, we're not exactly Bible Belt, but yeah, the culture is definitely eroding, but we don't look to the culture for answers. I guess that'll lead me into a question here, kind of a segment on what we're contemplating. There's a couple things I've been reading, and since this is on point, I guess we'll just jump right there. I've been reading a dissertation by a guy named Leonardo De Chirico, and he has written a very useful dissertation considering and studying evangelical assessments of Roman Catholicism, particularly after Vatican II. Now, that's a topic that interests me already, but I know a lot of our listeners and YouTube brothers may or may not be wanting to pick that up in and of its own accord. But he does treat in two sections somewhat extensively Cornelius Van Til and how Van Til fits into this, as well as Paul Wells, G.C. Burkhauer, and a couple other figures. Donald Blush is one of them. And so one thing that he mentions in there, which I thought was interesting and provocative, and I'm chewing on this, so this is a thing I'm contemplating, is he was assessing ECT, you know, evangelicals and Catholics together, which was kind of an unofficial movement. It wasn't an official ecumenical movement between some evangelical organization and Rome, but there were evangelicals and Catholics who came together and basically,
Coulson,
yeah,
and
Chuck
Richard
Coulson.
Newhouse in
Here's
particular.
The thought here, though. He argues that would have been impossible apart from a contemporary American context. And in fact, evangelicals in other countries, they don't necessarily have a construct or even a desire for doing something like ECT. So the explanatory paradigm for ECT, like how ECT happened and why, as far as I'm understanding De Chirico on this point, he seems to argue that the reason this comes about is because of certain views of the public square and the need for certain evangelicals and certain Catholics to find a common ground so that they can both battle the culture and fight and win the cultural wars. But he says, apart from that context and those political aims and desires, ECT wouldn't have happened and would be completely unnecessary.
Yeah, I think that's actually true. Having lived through, as an adult, through much of this era from 1976 forward, I wasn't an adult in 76, I was 12. But I do remember four. Much of this, much of the from the early 80s onward, and I do remember I was an adult when ECT first came out, and then the various permutations after that of the doc, and the latest one being the Manhattan Declaration is kind of the latest iteration of that mindset. This all comes about because of the culture wars and co-belligerency. Yep. The idea that in the past, Protestants and Catholics would not do a lot of things together. But because the culture is eroding, and much of it becoming paganized or re-paganized, however you want to look at it, there's a necessity, or at least some see that is a necessity to work with others who profess to be believers, or some that aren't necessarily professing to be Christians at all, but who, for instance, oppose abortion or gay marriage or some other such thing, whatever the issue might be. They come together, and I could see in the down the road Muslims being involved and conservative Jews being involved, and they have been.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Manhattan Declaration, if I remember correctly, involved both Protestants, Catholics, and Eastern Orthodox, so the three main branches of Christianity, Christendom, we'll put it that way, and they might have included some Muslims and conservative Jews who would also be opposed to gay marriage and things like that, and abortion, etc. So I think that's actually an accurate assessment. There's something unique about the American context. Now, why is it that, because the same kinds of social issues are faced in other countries. When I was in Taiwan a year ago, questions were asked about how do we deal with these things? And I'm thinking, well, it's good to know that misery loves company, that this is an international problem. These are international problems. They're not unique to America. So what is it about America that did he give any above and beyond recognizing that it may be the American context which accounts for this?
Yeah.
But why does it account for it?
Well, that'd be a
what
question
is it about
for
American culture? Pluralism? Is it pluralism? That kind of thing that we're now in a minority, but maybe Christians in Europe.
This may be yet to
that?
Come in the dissertation. I've read more than half of it. Right. I'm about
192
pages in, and it's about 350, I think. I've got a PDF of it. So I've been reading that, and perhaps that's going to be an assessment later on. But to me, thus far, it doesn't seem like that particular question is the direct aim or thesis of the dissertation.
I understand it's probably a side eddy. By the way, he has a website. Regarding his work in Italy.
That's great. Yeah, I'd like to talk to him.
He writes on occasion for Reformation 21.
Yes, he does. Yeah, it's very good.
So that's
a good point, Jeff. And I think, I think it has to do largely with this notion of the culture wars and all therein. This notion of a particular Americanized version of trying
what's
going on.
It's the idea that America was Christian and that heritage has been lost,
right.
And they're trying to regain it, right? That's
right.
Probably – that could be what drives it, and that's what's not present in other countries perhaps.
Perhaps.
It's been a long time since Christendom fell apart going back to Renaissance. You want to go way back to
Holy Roman Empire.
Holy Roman Empire, which is not none of those things, right?
Sure. But,
yeah. It was neither Roman nor holy nor an empire. Right?
Or an empire, right?
So, I think that's right. A lot of this is, I mean, you go back and you just read the history, particularly of American Christianity, right up to, thinking of in terms of particularly the Second Great Awakening, right? And kind of frontier evangelism and this perceived need to Christianize the land and all of that, and then having seen the culture move away from that in very pronounced ways, I think if we believe that our goal, that our calling, that it is absolutely necessary that Christians dominate the culture and the society and the land in which they live, then there's going to be, you know, kind of this perception as you look around, you go, not only are we small, but our numbers are getting smaller. And with these type of small numbers, there's no way that we're going to be able to take dominion, right? The way in which, which we need to. And so what we need to do is we need to lock arms with other
whoever's closest.
Whoever's closest and lock arms with them so that we can accomplish the task of taking dominion. And that anytime that there is this perceived need or call to as it were, conquer the land, right? To kind of, and that, I'm purposely making allusion here to the land conquest of Israel under the Old Testament, right?
Joshua, you know, just and Judges.
That's right. Just as Israel was to conquer the land and take possession of it for the Lord, so likewise we today, it is perceived by some, must conquer the land in which the Lord has placed us. And especially if you couple it with the language that you find in the early days of America where the land is kind of perceived as a new promised land.
City on a hill.
Christians are the city on the hill and you know, all this other stuff, it kind of this this conquest idea, which really does come more from a theology of glory than the theology of the cross, right? It's this idea that we advance God's kingdom in this land by way of human instrumentation, whether it be at the voting booth or it be through politics or it be through military or it be through whatever means there is that we have to take possession of the land.
I would want to nuance things a little finer and say there may be some people who, and I don't have a problem with co-belligerency as long as, but see, that has never led me to think that Roman Catholics, qua Roman Catholics or EOs, qua Eastern Orthodox folk, are sound or are saved. Now, we don't deny that there are folk in the Catholic Church who are saved or in other branches. But it's in spite of, not because of what their denomination, their tradition teaches. But a lot of this is really residual of medieval Christendom, right? The other thing is you can fight against the erosion of morality without thinking that you're trying to gain dominion. You may you may be thinking, well, as a Christian, I have to vote my conscience.
Well, and there's certainly ways that you could be more of a Vossian type, for example, and still have very strong views about how you live as a Christian. That's not to say that either. You know, I have strong views about politics and this, that, and the other, but I don't necessarily share the basic belief or the tactics with some of my Theonomist brothers, for example.
Right.
And there's a range of opinion, even over those who would prefer to take dominion. You know, you think about all the different stripes and varieties of Reconstructionists or Theonomists or Neo-Kyperians or Neo-Calvinists and Transformationalists and, you know, Two Kingdoms people who still want to find a neutral or an open public square for natural law and natural reason and then make headway in the cultural wars there. So there's all sorts of different approaches, which is nice in one regard, that we can try to come at these things from different angles and try to understand most basically and most specifically what the Lord is teaching us. But it also can be tremendously frustrating when we're trying to understand these things and deal with other Christians.
All I was saying was actually preliminary to getting at why how this brings about ECT, and that is simply people get to know one another and they become friends where they, in the past, you might not associate. And now you say, well, this is a good person's a nice person. And I can see how it can happen that you slip from this is a nice person to this must be a Christian.
Yeah. Or that we need to have some sort of a pseudo ecumenical document.
Right. And I think that's what happens.
Sure.
You move from associating with people and becoming friends. And there's always this desire, I suppose, to make our friends in our image so that they have to be like us in every last detail.
Yeah.
As opposed to recognizing that I could be a friend with a Roman Catholic or with a conservative Jew or even a Muslim and recognize that's what they are.
Or Jeff, you and I can still long suffer our friend Jim, even though he cheers for the Mets and the Giants.
Oh, I know. That is such a challenge.
Hey, you know, you all are welcome to come over to the right side. I mean, at any time. I mean, we welcome you as Giants and Mets fans.
I got one more theological worthwhile thought, but before I get to that, I do want to open up. I was talking to our buddy Dan Ragusa, and he was aware of some Mets Jets fans. Jim and I have this long going thesis that in New York, it is exceedingly difficult, perhaps impossible, to find someone who truly roots for both in good times and bad, mostly bad, but truly roots for both the New York Mets and the New York Jets. Because my theory is no single human being could take that much disappointment.
Yeah, that's just
the, so. If you're Mets fan, nobody's that. If you're a Mets fan, you are always got to be a Giants fan. And if you are a Yankee fan, then you can possibly root for the Jets.
Yeah, you got to have something to look forward to. Because if you're a Jets-Mets fan, even worse would be Jets-Mets-Islanders or something like that. I mean,
I'm pretty sure only someone from Long Island or New York City or maybe Connecticut or New Jersey would actually be correlating these things, because I'm going, okay.
Yeah, well, you're close enough, closer than I was. But let me.
Well, yeah, but I'm a Red Sox fan, so I know. I hate New York teams by definition.
I hear you. I hear you there. But let me just put it out there. If there's a listener out there and you are or know of a true dyed-in-the-wool Mets and Jets fan, let us know. But especially if you can find a Mets, Jets, Islanders fan, we want to know this person and we want to reach out and help.
Perhaps we could preach the gospel to them and grant them some comfort.
Thus spake the Cub fan who now has a title under his belt from 2 years ago. All right, one more thing I want to bring up, and this is kind of a I'm chewing on this and working through another dissertation by a pastor friend of mine who was my pastor for 17 and a half years when I was growing up. His name is Trevor Smith. He just completed his doctoral work at the University of Middlesex, or maybe Middlesex University over in London. So I'm curious to talk to him and learn more about how this program works, because it looks like they often do their theological work in conjunction with other institutions, particularly with the London School of Theology. So I don't know. If somebody knows about that, I'd like to learn about that too. Because we might have some people, some seminary grads someday who might want to do some work in the UK, and that might be a good option for them. Regardless, Trevor writes about, this is way out of my field, but I'm very interested in it. He's writing about African theology, particularly looking at four guys, but one that he mentions often is a guy named Kwame Bediako, who's now passed away, but a very well-known theologian, I believe, who hailed from Ghana. But the dissertation is looking at what he calls, what Trevor calls, a single-tiered unitive perspective. Now, that's somewhat a neologism or a new phrase that he's coined, but you could very well translate it, he thinks, and he might when it gets published, called it a single-tiered ontological perspective. Here's the basic idea. He says that Africans natively do not have the same type of basic worldview that Westerners often have post-Enlightenment, that there's not an ingrained, deep-seated distinction, division, and separation between the things that are seen and the things that are not seen, between the material world and the immaterial world, or to use Kant's categories even, between the phenomena and the noumena. And so his contention here is that he's not saying that Africans by nature are Christians, but he is arguing that there is something inherent in the African worldview that allows for Africans not to fall prey to the problems that the West has had since the Enlightenment. And they have kind of a natural resiliency, or kind of like almost these worldview antibodies against Kant. And therefore, you know, if I'm translating this, you know, as a Vantillian, I'm thinking, oh, that's kind of interesting. So you think that certainly perhaps people who live in Africa may or may not have more borrowed capital, or at least may not be suppressing the truth in unrighteousness the same way that the West does so often. So it's an interesting thought to connect epistemology and worldview with you know, intellectual development throughout the ages. Now sociologists and missiologists have acknowledged that this may be the case, but they long thought it was because African countries were not well educated. And so they contended that once education came to Africa, then these worldview problems would shift and that they would move down the same trajectory that the West has. You know, and so thus happens in Europe, and then maybe 15, 20 years later happens in the United States, and then maybe 20, 30, 40 years after that happens in Africa. That's kind of the thought that people have, this inevitable progression towards, you know, more and more secularism. Trevor argues that and demonstrates how missiologists and sociologists have found that even with the increase in education in Africa, that's not true, that this, what he calls a single-tiered unitive perspective, or what we might say these epistemological or worldview antibodies, seem to be even resistant to Western education. It's an interesting thought. And, you know, it's not I'm not reading this or thinking about this in terms of finding, you know, some form of anonymous Christianity, but I would cast it in terms of, you know, uncovering some forms of borrowed capital and thinking more deeply about the ways in which our Western culture even shape the way we think. And that's always a good thing, to always analyze our presuppositions and take every thought captive to the obedience
of
Christ.
You have a question, if I may.
Yeah,
Father.
Please.
When he's dealing with Africa, is he generalizing? Because I think of North Africa and Augustine. Augustine was influenced by Neoplatonism.
He's focused on Ghana. Ghana. So we don't want to say Africa as a whole because it's a diverse place. It's a continent. But I think these four thinkers in Ghana have also proven rather representative for
that's
a lot
interesting.
Of it. Right.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating.
It'd be interesting to talk to some of our friends like Philip Tatchin in Nigeria. It'd be interesting to follow up with guys like that to see, you know, after reading and discussing this dissertation, to see if they have found the same things in other cultures and countries within that continent.
Because I think it's sometimes what we attribute to Kant, the noumenal phenomenalist, actually goes back to Plato and the ideas, forms, and the world of fluctuation. The distinction there is goes way back before Kant. Kant just gives a particular articulation of the subject-object divide.
Yeah.
In other words, it's really not Kantian. It's, you know, unless you get to the details of Kant, you know, where he says that we can only know the phenomena and God and his revelation and morality and the human soul are things we can't know. They're not the subject of science, but of value, or the fact-value dichotomy. These are, again, all various formulations of the subject-object distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Or the one and the many. You know, but anyways, so it could be in our bloodstream as Westerners because it's been there for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
Or more than just a couple hundred years going back to Kant, but going back to Plato.
Absolutely.
And perhaps before that.
Well, very good. Jim, you have any thoughts on that? I'm just kind of halfway through the dissertation myself, so it's just something that I'm chewing on.
Fascinating stuff. I'm just listening in on the conversation here and don't have any particular thoughts at this time. Nothing that it's percolated long enough worth speaking.
Yeah, well, me neither, because this is just a whole different world. But it I think we ought to think more deeply. And you remember that interview you did with Daniel Strange, Jim? That was a spectacular interview. Their Rock is Not Our Rock, I think. And it was really looking at a Van Til view of missions as well, and understanding polemics properly with other cultures and with other religions. We got to be reminded that Christianity is not a Western thing. And I don't mean to say that it's not Western because it's something else colloquial or local. It's truth, period. It's God's truth. So Christianity needs to be, you know, a global movement, a global thought. The church is global. It's a universal church. And so, you know, just reading this, I'm thinking, holy cow. Well, maybe I didn't say that. Their cows aren't holy. But there's my cubness coming out with Harry Carey. But I'm just thinking, man, there's a lot out there that we just don't know. And it's helpful to get outside of our comfort zones and read theologies that, you know, all I'm trying to say is we have our heroes. I love reading Voss, Van Til. I love reading the Westminster tradition and post-Reformation Reform dogmatics. But that shouldn't be my only diet. It shouldn't be anybody's only diet. We need to read more broadly and think more deeply and can be conversant with global Christianity and seek to the maturity of all Christian people, no matter where they are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you give the name of the dissertation author again?
It's the name of the author is Trevor H.G. Smith. It's just normal Smith, S-M-I-T-H. The title of the work is Christian Theology Emerging from the Aiken Single-Tiered Unitive Perspective on Reality. I'll put a link to
that
in the episode.
Where's that dissertation done?
It was done at Middlesex University. Let's see here. It was a thesis submitted in partial fulfillment of the degree of Doctor of Philosophy in the University of Middlesex. So that's in London. Again, I'm curious about that program. I was reading about it online. I need to talk to Trevor about it more. But good stuff. So Aiken or Akan, I don't know if it's Aiken or Akan, but that's kind of the tribe. Yeah.
And where can you get that dissertation from?
Well, if you know Trevor, he can email it to
you. Oh, okay. All right. I wasn't sure if it was published or
it may
like
be
that,
because over in the UK they often make all approved dissertations available online. I will do my best to get a link to it or more information to it in the episode description. Failing that, I believe he is going to pursue publication. So that might take some time. You know how that works, but it might come out as a published book with somebody in the future. But we'll talk more about it. I'll keep reading, keep thinking, and maybe we'll have a follow-up. Yeah. Sound good?
Yep.
All right, guys.
Sound
well,
good.
It's been great talking to you both, and we hope everybody has enjoyed the episode. We like doing these open-ended ones once in a while, but we'll get back to more interviews soon enough. We got some great ones lined up and really interesting ones. We got Bill Dennison coming back, Alan Strange coming back. We're working with David Filson. So getting a lot of these things scheduled and look for them in the future. Until then, you can get a hold of us at mail@reformedforum.org. You can visit us on the website. We ask that you consider even supporting us with a financial pledge at reformedforum.org/donate. And you can also tweet us at Reformed Forum. We all want to thank you for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.